Hey, good morning, everybody. It's time for us to get started. So we are in Joshua chapter 1. I think we left off about verse 10 last week. So we spent some time focusing on God's commission of Joshua. We've introduced some of the big questions of the book. Is Joshua going to be able to fill Moses' shoes? Is this generation of Israel going to be more faithful and more obedient than their parents who died in the wilderness? Let's go ahead and jump into our text today, starting in chapter 1, verse 10. And Joshua commanded the officers of the people, "Pass through the midst of the camp and command the people, prepare your provisions. For within 3 days you are to pass over this Jordan to go in to take possession of the land that the Lord your God is giving you to possess." And to the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh, Joshua said, "Remember the word that Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded you, saying, 'The Lord your God is providing you a place of rest and will give you this land. Your wives, your little ones, and your livestock shall remain in the land that Moses gave you beyond the Jordan. But all the men of valor among you shall pass over armed before your brothers and shall help them, until the Lord gives rest to your brothers as he has to you. And they also take possession of the land that the Lord your God is giving them. Then you shall return to the land of your possession and shall possess it, the land that Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave you beyond the Jordan toward the sunrise.'" All right, so Joshua goes in to issue commands in the camp, and it begins with this command to prepare your provisions, because within 3 days you're to pass over the Jordan, go in and take possession of the land. All right, now, we've not gotten to the crossing of the Jordan yet, but I think most of you probably remember the story. So I'll give you some spoilers. It is going to be a miraculous crossing, because this crossing bookends the whole Exodus journey. Right? The Exodus begins with a miraculous water crossing, and it's going to end with a miraculous water crossing. And so at this point in Israel's history, we're directed to think back to that first Passover. Another spoiler, by the way, Israel is about to keep the Passover before they enter in to conquer the Promised Land. But we'll come to that when we come to it. But we're supposed to have the original Passover in mind. We're supposed to have the Red Sea crossing in mind as we consider Israel at this point. And I want you to notice something. All right, whenever, well, let me ask it this way. At the Passover, what kind of bread do you eat? Unleavened bread. Why unleavened? Yes, because they had to leave in haste. Yes, so the leavening is all supposed to be cleaned out. They're to eat unleavened bread because they don't even have enough time to leaven the bread. Right? They're bugging out, as it were. They are going to skedaddle. Now, contrast that over and against this. What's Joshua's first instruction for the people as they are about to enter into the Promised Land? Prepare your provisions, because in 3 days you're going to pass over or cross over to conquer the land. So they escape in haste from Egypt, but here they're going to be taking their time. They're going to prepare their provisions. As they begin to conquer the land, even in this small detail, we should see that the Lord is already fulfilling his promise to them. He's already beginning to grant them the rest that he promised them. So they're going to be taking 3 days rather than bugging out with whatever they can carry on their back. All right, Wayne, did you have something?
Produce from the land for the first time
Yes.
They no longer got the manna.
Yes. Mm-hmm. In terms of food, no. Yeah, so like they're not, when he says prepare your provisions, they're not preparing food. But they, right, yeah, they're not preparing bread. Right, yeah. So what we're focusing on is kind of the time scale of things, whereas they leave in haste, but they arrive in preparation. Let's see. From there, Joshua then turns his attention to the eastern tribes. So you'll remember that as Israel comes into the plains of Moab, and they defeat the king of Sihon, the king of Og, some of these Ammonite kings, the tribe of Reuben, the tribe of Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh see this land that they've just defeated the kings of, and they say, well, yeah, we like this place. Can we have this place? And so the Lord grants them, through Moses, that they can keep this as their land instead of crossing over the Jordan into the promised land proper, as it were. All right, so now we're in the situation where Israel's about to cross over, you know, down here around the River Jordan. They're going to cross over to take Jericho, we will learn later. But you have these 2.5 tribes that have already received their land. And this is a potentially precarious situation because, you know, they've already got their land. You could almost think of it as, you know, having it on credit. Right, they have not had to go in and conquer the promised land. They just already have this land and the rest of Israel doesn't. And they have promised that they are going to then later help go in and conquer the actual promised land. So they get their land first and then the conquest. Now, how common is it for somebody to leave home and fight on behalf of another person of their own free will? You know, if you think about the previous generation in Israel, you know, if they had been given their land, do we think they would have remained faithful to the promise that they had made? This is a big test here. Right? We've asked, is Israel going to be faithful? Or are they going to be like the generation of their parents? So we will see in just a moment what their answer is. Joshua calls these things to mind. He issues the command, but we've not seen their answer yet. In his commission of the 2.5 eastern tribes, Joshua brings up the rest. He says, the Lord your God is providing you a place of rest and will give you this land. This is the first time that we hear about the rest in the book of Joshua, and this is a major, major theme of the book. That Israel is going in to receive rest in the promised land. The eastern tribes have been given the land of their rest, and they are to help their brothers receive the land of their rest. So we'll trace that throughout the book, this idea of Israel going in to receive rest. I think we mentioned last Sunday that, of course, this is something that gets picked up on throughout the rest of the Bible, right? Not just something that's focused on in Joshua, but the rest of the scriptures understand the rest of the promised land to point to something bigger and something fuller. So, for example, the Hebrew writer, writing, you know, much, 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 much later, recognizes that the rest that God promises is not just some kind of physical rest that people receive, you know, whenever they have settled into a home. But the Hebrew writer understands that spiritually. And so the Hebrew writer tells us that Joshua was not able to provide that spiritual rest, but that's ultimately what God has been promising from the very beginning. He demonstrates or teaches about that rest by way of types and images, beginning here with Israel going into the promised land to conquer it and to receive that physical rest. We should also note here that we see Joshua's role as a prophet. Right? We talked a couple of weeks ago about Joshua's place in the Old Testament. And our English Old Testaments arrange the Old Testament according to the Greek arrangement. So you've got law, history, poetry, prophets. In the Hebrew arrangement of the Old Testament, you've got the law, the prophets, and the writings. And Joshua is the first book of the prophets. And so we said to look out for how Joshua acts as a prophet. Because we don't normally talk about him as if he was a prophet. We see him acting as a prophet, even beginning here. First off, you'll notice, he acts in exactly the same way Moses does. It was Moses' job to speak with the Lord, receive the word of the Lord, and then pass that on to Israel. Joshua is doing exactly the same thing. The book begins with the Lord addressing Joshua individually in the first 9 verses. And what we're getting here is that Joshua turns around and takes the word of the Lord and passes it on to the people, just as Moses did. And so in that way, he is acting as a prophet, passing the word of the Lord on to the rest of the people of Israel. He is also acting in the same way as one of the latter prophets. The job of the latter prophets, like Isaiah and Jeremiah, Ezekiel, their job was to preach the covenant to Israel, right? To call the law to remembrance, to tell Israel, this is what Moses has said, you need to keep these commandments. Joshua has done exactly that in the way that he addresses the tribes on the other side of the Jordan. Remember the word that Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded you, saying, the Lord your God is providing you a place of rest and will give you this land. He is calling the law to remembrance and admonishing them to obey, to do as they said that they would do. And so in this, Joshua is functioning as a prophet. All right, the last thing that I want us to consider from this passage is that this story acts as an important lesson for future Israel, for Israel yet to come. At this point, Israel is already divided between east and west. We're going to see this division played up over the course of the book of Joshua. But it begins here. You've got these tribes that have already received their land, and you've got tribes that have not yet received their land. Will the eastern tribes be faithful? Will they help their brothers, as Joshua commands them to do? Now, looking at the way that they handle this division is going to be, or at least should have been, really fruitful for any Israelite coming along later. Because ultimately, what happens to the kingdom of Israel? It's divided north and south. So how is Israel going to treat, their brothers, other tribes, after they've divided north and south? Will they remain faithful to each other? What the book gives us is an example of how Israel did act the first time that they were divided. Joshua commands them, you are to help your brothers, and we'll see the response in just a second. That should have been a lesson for future Israel whenever they split into southern Judah and the remaining northern tribes forming the rest of Israel. What we ultimately find later, though, in Israel's history is that they are not faithful to each other. They do not help their brothers whenever they're divided north and south. All right, so any questions or comments about this passage before we get to their response? Louise. Probably. We get the three-day figure several times here in Joshua. We're going to get it here. We're going to get it in the Rahab story in chapter 2. And there's at least one other occasion before they cross the Jordan where we get a period of 3 days. So it's an interesting observation that you get three threes. And I suspect that we are supposed to take some kind of messianic reading out of this. At the very least, if Paul tells us that we should see the Red Sea crossing as a type of baptism, then I think it's reasonable to say likewise that the Jordan crossing is a type for baptism. So, good question. Wayne? So what I think what's being signified here is a fullness of time, right? So 3 days allows him to be fully prepared. In the Rahab story, the spies are supposed to hide out for 3 days while the king's men search for them, because they're going to perform a full search. Likewise, you know, Christ remains in the grave for 3 days as a matter of the fullness of time. So yeah, I do think that there is a messianic angle to take to this. Particularly here as we find Joshua telling the eastern tribes, you are to help your brothers, we should hear some really, really, really early echoes of like how the church is supposed to act. Right? The same ethic that Joshua gave to the eastern tribes is still true for the church today. Right? Like the eastern tribes had received something. They already had their good things, but they were told that they're supposed to help their brothers who didn't have what they were supposed to receive. That same kind of ethic applies in the church as we consider each other, that we help one another. And not just materially. So, good question and good observations. Let's go ahead and get to Israel's response to Joshua. Let's go to verse 16. And they answered Joshua, "All that you have commanded us, we will do. Wherever you send us, we will go. Just as we obeyed Moses in all things, so will we obey you. Only may the Lord your God be with you as he was with Moses. Whoever rebels against your commandment and disobeys your words, whatever you command him shall be put to death. Only be strong and courageous." All right, so Joshua, the book of Joshua doesn't leave us in any kind of suspense about whether Israel is going to be obedient or not, at least on this point. We get an immediate answer about what kind of people Israel is going to be, at least in this generation. The eastern tribes, the first ones that you would expect to rebel, pledge their loyalty to Joshua. They pledge their loyalty to the Lord's commandments. They recognize Joshua's position as Moses' heir. Now, there is something here. Verse 17, I don't know, it hits me a little funny. Maybe it hits you funny too. Just as we obeyed Moses in all things. Who's we? Overall, everything that they say is faithful. It's exactly the sorts of things that you would want them to say. But then you get just this little ominous shade in verse 17. Just as we obeyed Moses in all things, so will we obey you. We'll see if anything comes of that. I don't know about that. So we'll have to see how this plays out. Does Israel actually turn out to do everything that Joshua tells them to do? Yeah. Yes, Suzanne. I don't know if that's intended here. Yeah, it is an odd expression, at least to us. I'm not convinced that they're intending to put some distance between themselves and the Lord so much as they're trying to draw attention to the association between the Lord and Joshua and the Lord and Moses. Because at this point, like from here forward, pretty much everything that they say is confessional in nature. Meaning it's part of the pledge, right? Whoever rebels against your commandment, disobeys your words, whatever you command him shall be put to death. Only be strong and courageous. And so like by the end of this, only be strong and courageous. I don't think we're necessarily supposed to take that like as an imperative, right? Where the people of Israel are commanding Joshua, be strong and courageous. At this point, it's taken on more the sense of a motto, right? Or a confession. So I suspect what's going on here is that they mean, may the Lord be with you, in the way that we typically mean the phrase, may the Lord be with you. But there's a possibility there that this, at the very least, the way it's worded, implies some distance between the people and God. So we'll see how that plays out too. That's a good observation, Suzanne. Let's see. All right. Any other questions or comments on this passage? Go ahead.
And they believe the children run out of time.
Yeah.
I wonder if they also left behind some protective gear or something like that, kind of watch over their women and children, or was this purely dependence on the Lord's
I think that's the sense that we get, because he says, the women and children can stay home, but all the men of valor must go armed before your brothers. And that, I think, is why, that's a big part of why we should see this as a precarious situation. That, again, would you want to leave all of your dependents behind to go fight on somebody else's behalf? Like, there are a lot of people that do it, but not a lot of people that want to do that. Right? And so this is the point where you would expect to see some serious tension, some cracks in the armor of faith, as it were. And yet here we find these eastern tribes answering Joshua in faith, pledging themselves to do as they were commanded. So that's the really distinguishing thing here about them. All right. Well, I wanted to go ahead and get into the Rahab story at least a little bit today, because I had not intended on taking two classes on chapter one, but we're still getting things figured out. Let's go ahead and break into chapter two. We got about 5 minutes left. Most of us know the Rahab story already. Let's go through verses 1 through 7, chapter 2. And Joshua the son of Nun sent two men secretly from Shittim as spies, saying, "Go view the land, especially Jericho." And they went and came into the house of a prostitute whose name was Rahab, and they lodged there. And it was told to the king of Jericho, "Behold, men of Israel have come here tonight to search out the land." Then the king of Jericho sent to Rahab, saying, "Bring out the men who have come to you, who entered your house, for they have come to search out all the land." But the woman had taken the two men and hidden them. And she said, "True, the men came to me, but I did not know where they were from. And when the gate was about to be closed at dark, the men went out. I do not know where the men went. Pursue them quickly, for you will overtake them." But she had brought them up to the roof and hid them with the stalks of flax that she had laid in order on the roof. So the men pursued after them on the way to the Jordan as far as the fords. And the gate was shut as soon as the pursuers had gone out. All right, so this part of the text sets us up. Rahab's hiding of the spies. It starts with Joshua giving the command for two men to go view the land. Now, we've already had it on our minds that we're supposed to be comparing things from Joshua to what happened during the Exodus. So we've got a pretty clear, obvious parallel here. What's supposed to be on our minds as these two men are going in to spy out the land? The 12 men that went to spy out the land before. All right, and again, there we saw a faithless response from Israel. And so now the question should be on our minds, what kind of response are we going to get here? First off, what kind of report are these spies going to bring back? Are they going to be like the 10 who brought back a bad report? Or are they going to bring back a good report? And what's Israel going to do at that point? We are told that they come into Jericho and come into the house of a prostitute whose name was Rahab, and they lodged there. So they're staying at a prostitute's house. In antiquity, it does not necessarily mean that they were using her services. The law of Moses showed us that God is usually pretty quick to respond to Israel when they engage in sexual immorality. Right? You remember it's actually as they're encamped on the plains of Moab, right? Basically in exactly the same place where they are now, just earlier on. Remember some of the men of Israel fornicated with the women of Moab. And remember, the women of Moab led them to make sacrifices to Baal Peor. Do y'all remember what happened to Israel as a result of that? This was in Numbers 25. In short, like 23,000 people died in Israel as a result of that. Likewise, whenever whenever they make the golden calf, there's, at least in the language of it, there's an implication that there's some immorality going on, beyond the idolatry. And they are likewise punished there. The text here doesn't really imply that these two guys are going in to be immoral with Rahab. While we're on the issue of immorality, Let's just briefly turn our attention to Rahab's lie. Because Rahab pretty clearly lies to the men that the king of Jericho has sent. The only thing I want us to notice here is that the fact that Rahab lied is not the focus of the story. The story does not talk about... So the story shows us Rahab lying. The story does not talk about whether Rahab's lie is good or bad or anything. So if anybody tries coming to this story to excuse lying, oh, you see, Rahab did it, that's... The text isn't interested in that, right? The story's not there to excuse lying. Now, the text also does not condemn the lie, because the story, again, is not particularly interested in whether she's a liar or not. It's also really not all that interested in dealing with her status as a prostitute either. We just get the report that she is a prostitute. Right? So just like you wouldn't come to this passage to excuse lying, you also wouldn't come to this passage to excuse prostitution. The story is ultimately about the way that Rahab betrays her Canaanite people in favor of Israel. And that's really what the story is about. It's like with the patriarchs. The stories of the patriarchs are recorded to show us when they are faithful. Right? So we get all kinds of stories about Abraham's faith. We get some stories about Jacob's faith. How much bad stuff did Abraham do? I mean, we studied that as we were going through Genesis. Abraham is not... he's not spotless by any stretch of the imagination. And yet, that's not the focus of the story. Right? So basically, what I'm saying is we need to treat Rahab kind of the same way that we treat the patriarchs. Right? You don't go to Jacob, the story of Jacob, and say, ah, you see, there, that's where the Bible tells us that it is okay to have multiple wives. Right? If you were to try to do that, that's not what the Bible's telling you. Right? The Bible's just reporting that Jacob had multiple wives. The same goes for Rahab and what she does here, being a prostitute and engaging in lying. The focus is on how Rahab welcomes the spies, hides them from her own people, and sends her people the other way, so that Israel can succeed. All right, now we're going to see the purpose of all of that, why Rahab is betraying her own people in the next passage, but we're out of time for it. Any questions or comments before we dismiss today? Okay. Well, thank you so much for your questions and comments today and your kind attention. We will pick up in the middle of the Rahab story next Sunday. So she's hid the spies. Actually, this is a good cliffhanger ending. The last thing we read was the gate was shut as soon as the pursuers were gone out. So what are these spies going to do to be able to get out of Jericho and take their report back? Dun, dun, dun. Find out in the next thrilling episode.